Chili. I'll tell you something. I want to be a judge for a chili cook-off someday, I think, because I'm beginning to really appreciate a lot of different recipes out there for chili across this country. And Bar Bar, set the standard very high, but we had competition this time around. You'll see how right here.
So, as you probably heard, we had a chili challenge that started off. Bart Barr over at Westminster, Ian Barr's mom, had the best chili so far in the 14 years, 15 seasons of In the Huddle. Now, sir, you are
Chuck Dubois.
Chuck. Now, did you make the chili that I'm about to try
I
yourself?
made the chili myself.
So, if our producer here comes in, we'll take a look that they don't fool around with their chili as well. Chuck, what makes your chili so good?
I smoke it.
You smoke your chili.
I do.
That's impressive right there. So we've already gotten this ready to go. Now, cheese and everything. Barb, I don't know if you smoke your chili out there, but here we go. I'm gonna try this. I'm nervous because I could hurt somebody's feelings right now doing this.
And I'm a lot closer than Barb is.
So I'm gonna tell you what. This is the cold open for our next show, and I'm going to reveal the winner on the next show.
Okay, so who do you think I'm picking? If you had to guess here now, after seeing that and having seen last year's version of it, who, based on just facial reactions during my eating of the chili, would you say I pick?
I mean, I imagine that that guy's chili was probably really good, but you have to have a soft spot for Barb. I know you're kind of a bit of a mama's boy, Frank. I just can't imagine you liking somebody else's chili. I imagine that guy's is really good and very, very close, but I think I just feel like we gotta stick with Barb. Maybe it was the secret ingredients in her recipe.
So here we go. Not to hurt feelings. This is kind of like Davy Page used there on Barstool Pizza Review suddenly, and this is like the difference between one of his 9.8 to 9.7s, and I don't think he even goes that high normally when he's doing the grades. But it really was that close, and I'm going to give the nod to Barb just slightly. She has a very hearty chili, so did Chuck. But Chuck's smoked
Smoked, you said,
version,
right?
yeah, it was smoked meat. Was good if he had used the more I guess he used a different meat than he would normally use for this, so less surface area for the smoking to hit it, because he would use more of a shredded
Okay.
meat variety. That probably would have put him over the top. That's my guess, but just ever so slightly, Bar wins this chili cook-off so far. But there's more games to go to throughout this season. Also, before we start the show, I want to give some observations from the other day. Feel free to interject your thoughts from what you were seeing going on there. First, I want to say Ryan Stevens, class act. Fully a class act. We compare him to David Tamayo, and I was actually talking to Dave's dad the other day when he saw that. I was actually covering another Johns Hopkins game, and I said it to him, and I'll say it to everybody else. After the game, Ryan Stevens was like, "Hey, how are you?" And tough one, but hey, we're still in this essentially. Come to our tailgate afterward, even though it was on the losing end. And I'll tell you, Johns Hopkins knows how to party in win or lose effort. I
They're
passed
just
them
not smart
more
guys there. They're party guys, huh?
between the two tailgates. I passed them more Jell-O shots, Chirin shots, and pudding shots than I think I ever have passed up in my entire college career, let alone being at a
Wow.
football game. So these
The
folks know how to
Centennial's
do it.
bringing it.
Yep, absolutely. Having a good time and enjoying football respectfully. But Ryan Stevens, my hat's off to you, bud, because you epitomize class act here when it comes to Division III football. Okay. Susquehanna, what a great tailgate scene they had. I took pictures of it. It didn't even explain the half of it,
Yeah.
the food, the setup, and everything else. Wow. But Johns Hopkins with the full bar, actually, somebody brings too, and their line of
Okay,
tents going on both sides. That gauntlet experience is incredible as well. And got to meet Ryan Stevens' mother, who was the one that scares him more than the sisters. Remember that on the show? And
yeah,
she
yeah, I
introduced
do remember that from a
herself.
couple of weeks back.
She introduced herself as the one that scares Ryan, and I can see why. She's she's got that football chutzpah about her. I could tell right away. So, Ryan, I got you on that one too. Michael Roush and Dewey Dalton, who you saw me interview this weekend. We actually had to post a minute that got clipped out for whatever reason on our connection issues. We were uploading that. What a family that is there. And for those that were coming into the season wondering about the fifth year effect that some of these schools might have, Susquehanna is epitomizing the fifth year effect. We talk about those six guys that came back. They're all strong guys, leaders in that team. And so look no further than Susquehanna if you're looking at how a team can have the COVID year scenario help them ultimately get the crux back for a year and win games the way they are right now. That was an incredible win, although a lot of point chasing going on in that game. We'll look at it in crunch time coming up. But what an all-around great experience. Thanks to everybody out there. Coach Rulli's dad kind of took me under his wing and got me out there. And Dalton Simpson's family out there, and everybody out there. Elijah Hoffman, remember Elijah on the couch that came on the show on Friday? Well, his leg was a big deal. He was the kicker. So
yeah,
he.
I'm just really disappointed, Frank, though, that no one ever got you into that ragamuffin looking turnover jacket. I mean, that thing was straight out of the. And what's that? What was that old Macklemore song? I'm gonna pop some tags. The thrift shop. Holy cow! Yeah. That thing was like straight out of 1976.
Well, so am I. Yeah. So.
Hey.
Yeah. 1976, May 2nd. That's the birth date. So I think we had something in common with the turnover coat. But and the sad thing was there was a legitimate turnover at the end of the game. After the illegal forward pass went to the ground. Although, I guess technically, if an illegal forward pass hits the ground, it's an incompletion and kills the play. So, no, there wasn't a turnover there. At least there shouldn't have been by statistic. But either way, I think they hid that thing so that nobody would go steal it. I'm not sure why they would. But yeah. That was a great all-around day, like I said. And thanks to everybody on both sides of this rivalry game, this big centennial game, for having me. I know it's a long, cold open, but at the same time, it was a long Saturday for the right reasons for once, and I'm glad we could all be a part of it here on season 15 of In the Huddle. Okay, so while I was on the sideline at Susquehanna, you've started pinging me on Twitter about a play that we're going to look at pretty carefully later on at the end of the Utica-Morrisville game. That's one that we need to address for a couple different reasons. You want to talk about something that could actually affect playoffs a little bit, possibly? This is one of those negative scenarios that you don't want to see something like this happen. It affects Morrisville, that's for sure, because they could have gone 9-1 and been in the conversation. At 8-2, they will not be in that conversation. I can pretty much assure you at this point. Now they're looking at bowl games, but Coach Raby has things, you know, focused. Hopefully, there he's been saying some very mature coaching things about get your focus where it belongs. Now it was a horrible situation, but we'll move on. So good for him. We'll look at the play though more later for those that have been kind of pinging us about it along the way. We got crunch time coming up as well. But JB, one thing that's become crystal clear is that while we normally use week 10 to get a lot of answers about where things are going, we're going to be waiting till week 11. It's going to be kind of like election night where you don't have a lot of winners right away and you got to stay up through the night, maybe to the next day to get your answers. That's kind of what we're in right now with respect to a lot of conferences will go the distance here before we get Pool A winners and then get to talk about Pool C in certain cases. Your 30,000-foot view from week 9.
Well, first up, shout out to the Cortland Red Dragons for clinching their second consecutive Empire 8 title. They're the first team into the tournament. And to Frank's point, it's going to take until the end of week 11 to sort all this out. Next weekend, or really this upcoming week 10, about half the conferences in the country will have champions effectively selected. There could be a few extras here and there. For instance, Mountain Union won't really win the OAC if they beat John Carroll, but if Baldwin Wallace loses to Heidelberg, which is definitely possible, they will win and clinch the OAC. So I think the same thing is going on in the MASCAC. UMD can clinch if they win, and Plymouth State loses to Mass Maritime, which is a 500 club. Probably not going to happen. So in week 11, you have another, 12, 13, 14 conferences that are going to be decided. But we saw just a lot of craziness kind of happening, these amazing finishes at the end, a lot of wackiness. We saw a doink for the win out in Wisconsin. We saw these kickers in the Wyacker like nailing 52-yard field goals. I mean, it was amazing. And then, unfortunately, it just kind of, the whole Utica Mooresville official thing just kind of puts a bad taste in your mouth after all these great games that come down to the end. Even in the end of the Susquehanna game, came down to a 2-point conversion and a defensive back making a good play. I mean, I saw on Twitter someone saying, oh, but he was holding him. It looked like a good defensive play, in my opinion. But the thing for Mooresville kind of breaks my heart for them. And it's just kind of a bummer that the conference is just basically ignoring and not saying anything about it. I mean, it would be pretty simple to say, hey, upon further review, looks like a mistake was made here. I mean, the game's going to stand. And, I guess you and I, when we review our picks later, we can argue a little bit about that. Because I don't know if we can really, should that really count? I mean, technically you got it right, but Mooresville should won the game, but they just didn't win the game. It's kind of crazy.
Couple things. I'm not going to debate that point. Yeah, we'll get to it later. But two things that you brought up. Mass Dartmouth, they are idle this week. So they are just watching Plymouth State to see if they lose. But a much needed rest for Mass Dartmouth at a very long point in the season to wait for your bye, week 10. Yeah. But then also holding or something like that on the 2-point conversion play, no. They call that game consistently with respect to the offensive or defensive pass interference scenarios throughout the game, and that would not have qualified based on what they were or weren't calling. So I was actually very happy with the officiating. One of the officials was actually at the national championship game officiating last year and recognized me and asked me who I was working with, and we're having a good rapport because he made some good calls throughout the day, including the one that was the near catch but just barely out of bounds catch on the end zone to the right of the stands. If you're in the stands to the right end zone there. Okay. So he had some good calls throughout the day. And if anybody's going to pick on the officiating in that game, the only thing they did wrong was they didn't alert everybody as to the fact that that timeout was not used. So the scoreboard had the wrong number of timeouts up there. The coaches assumed that there was only two timeouts left, and you saw what almost happened with respect to Johns Hopkins having a free possession with very limited time on the clock there. So that was almost a near disaster, but that was just communication issues more than anything else. Okay, we're talking about these games in the abstract. Let's look at them directly here. That's why we do crunch time here for week 9 of the 2022 Division III college football season.
Out of fingers, Frank.
Yes, you are, and I can't wait for week 11 to see what you do with that one. Next week, you got one more that you can put up. Yeah, but let's go to, first off, Bridgewater State at Mass Dartmouth. No video here, but I'll tell you that Mass Dartmouth controlled this game for a 48-7 win. Luis Gonzalez with 17 rushes, 83 yards, 3 rushing touchdowns. Dante Avila Santos played 60 damn minutes of football, and he went 21 for 35, 349 yards, 1 passing touchdown, and an interception. Actually, he may have come out with that kind of score, but you get the point there. Springfield at Merchant Marine, an important game in the new MAC because it really would try to help us figure out what was going to happen in this conference with respect to Catholic and who to watch for. Well, first off, in the first quarter, 6:41 left.
Long fakes the handoff, throws, he's got Smith, he holds it in, and Kelson Smith is in the end zone! Long goes in the air, 43 yards, and the Mariners get the Ziggy off the board!
But Springfield in the third quarter, after a 10-10 halftime score, would get this passing touchdown from David Wells and Noah Wagenblast. The 8-yard touchdown made it 17-10 in favor of Springfield. In the fourth quarter, 11:45 left, Jacob Sylvester gets a 3-yard touchdown pass from David Wells, 24-13. They'd add a field goal to make it 27-13. Springfield wins the game and has a showdown with Catholic coming up in week 11. Wells, 169 total yards, 3 passing touchdowns, unusual to say the least, but hey, it got the job done. Jeremiah Wong from Merchant Marine, 223 total yards, 1 passing touchdown. In the new MAC also, this game we wanted to show you because it was a nail biter, Norwich at WPI. 3:14 left in the first quarter, Tykel Stewart from Norwich gets a 4-yard touchdown pass from Mitchell Thiel to make it 6-0, Norwich leading. But WPI responds, 8:31 left, second quarter, Hunter Carey, a 40-yard touchdown pass from Dante Cacagna makes it 7-6 in favor of WPI. Norwich, though, would get a 9-7 halftime lead in the fourth quarter. 14:12 left, Hunter Carey gets a run this time from 28 yards for the touchdown, 14-9 WPI, but hey, this is far from over. 5:24 left, he said, in the fourth quarter. Norwich's Trevor Chase gets an 18-yard touchdown pass from Thiel. It's 15-14 Norwich. Just 17 seconds later, Ryan Hannigan gets his 90-yard kickoff return for a touchdown. Make it 20-15. In favor of WPI, fourth quarter again, 5 minutes left. Now look at this, defensively, WPI has to still make a stand here. Third and 28, Thiel, with no time left on the clock, has to try to make something happen. And you can see that eventually it is fumbled, recovered by WPI, and that is the game. WPI wins that game 20-15 over Norwich. Thiel, 23 for 34, 231 yards, 2 passing touchdowns, and an interception. Hunter Carey, 15 rushes, 112 yards, 1 rushing touchdown on the day. Finally, a big game in the ECFC. Anna Maria at Gallaudet. And we'll start in the first quarter, 12 minutes into the game. Andre Green gets a 30-yard pick 6 here to give a 10-0 lead for Gallaudet. Then in the second quarter, look at this play here. This is important as Alex Cohen is sacked for a loss of 4 yards. And it's a safety, but more importantly, Cohen would not return in this game, and so that may have affected the real outcome of what happened for the rest of it. Late in the game, Anna Maria was up just 19-13, but Gallaudet, with 2:37 left, had a 16-yard run here for touchdown. D. McCall is what I show on my roster here, so I apologize for the lack of first name. But it's a necessary touchdown to give them a lead by the score of 27-13, and that would do it. Gallaudet wins that game by 14 and has a certain level of control now in the ECFC. Brandon Washington, 136 total yards for Gallaudet, 1 rushing touchdown. The defense from Gallaudet, 2 interceptions, 4 sacks, a fumble recovery. The offense, 41-48 time of possession, that's incredible, with 61 rush attempts. Region 1, still with some mysteries here, and even in the MAC, there's a mystery about whether or not Kings is going to be in the conversation for Pool C, JB, which is an interesting call. We'll look at that on Friday a little bit more, but Region 1, mystery abound because we have no real definitiveness in that region. Go ahead.
Yeah, but I think we are going to start getting some definitiveness come week 10. But as we can see here, I mean, Alfred State has kind of faded in the ECFC race. So really, Gallaudet can clinch this weekend with a win. We saw Plymouth State win. They're still in the running for the MASCAC. They're going to have to get by Mass Maritime this weekend, but they'll be favored in that one. Kings, I do think they're going to show up on the list for Region 1 as one of the 7 teams. We'll see. We'll talk about it more on Friday. They continue to win games. Framingham State bounces back. They might be in consideration potentially for a New England Bowl, perhaps, but the tough season for the Rams. Elsewhere, Husson takes down WNE. FU Forum wins 10-2. Stevenson cruising right along. I think they're another team, Frank, that's going to pop up on the list. They have a really strong strength of schedule. Even though they have two losses, I think they'll be on there. Tufts, man, their offensive line was named to the D3Football.com Team of the Week. They've generated over 600 yards. I think it's like the third most in Jumbo's history, so a big win for them. Wesleyan takes care of Amherst and OT. Middlebury hangs on by three. Williams wins. Coast Guard with a 31-24 win over MIT was interesting. And man, Salve just has really seemed to struggle this year, Frank. We thought they might contend for the CCC title, but they're sort of fading here late. Endicott cruising right along. They'll definitely be on the list. One of the top ranked teams in Region 1 there. And Widener takes care of Lebval. SUNY Maritime beats Dean. And in another close call, Western Connecticut's finding ways to win with a 38-35 win over Worcester State.
Endicott finally ranked in the top 25 of D3Football.com. In fact, finally. Congratulations to the Gulls. We've been promoting that for a while and finally happened. Let's go to Region 2 and to the best combined tailgate I've ever been a part of, to be honest with you, Johns Hopkins at Susquehanna. In the second quarter, already up 7-0, Kyle Hollis gets a 9-yard touchdown pass here from Michael Roosh to make it 14-0 in favor of Susquehanna. That's the end of our regular scoring from this game, because watch what starts to happen here. In the second quarter, 6:38 left, Johns Hopkins, Josh Pulsey gets a 25-yard touchdown pass from Ryan Stevens. It's 14-6 because the extra point was blocked. We'll be chasing that for a while here. 9 seconds left, second quarter. Hopkins looks to try to tie the game. Emmett Turner gets a 1-yard touchdown pass from Ryan Stevens. 14-12, but the two-point conversion, I'll tell you, was no good. So that was our halftime score, 14-12, Susquehanna. Third quarter, though, 9:02 left, and Hopkins takes their first lead of the game as Jeff Schroeder gets a 24-yard touchdown run. It's 18-17 in favor of Hopkins at this point. Third quarter's 3:46 left. Hunter Coulter with a 2-yard touchdown run for Susquehanna. This followed defensive pass interference, a very clear call in the end zone here that gave them the ball at the 2. It was 23-18 in favor of Susquehanna. Elijah Hoffman, we talked about him earlier and had him on the show briefly on Friday, gets a 37-yard field goal with 8:59 left to make it a full possession, 26-18 in favor of Susquehanna. But the remainder of the next 8-10 would belong to essentially Johns Hopkins. They went for a 17-play drive that was concluded by this Josh Pulsey 5-yard touchdown pass from Ryan Stevens, 26-24. And then you know what happens here. The 2-point conversion is knocked away by Keith Green III, and that would secure the victory ultimately. And we'll look at the final play, which was all around trying, Johns Hopkins to do something with the ball to get it downfield, but they were not able to do it. A legal forward pass was the flag that you see, and that would do it. A big win as Susquehanna wins at 26-24 to go to 8-0 on the season, 7-0 in the conference. Ryan Stevens for Johns Hopkins, we got to say though, 27 for 38, 273 yards, 3 passing touchdowns, but Michael Roosh not sacked in the game. That offensive line has allowed 1 sack all season. That's incredible. 237 total yards, 1 passing, 1 rushing touchdown, and an interception on the day. We go from that high to this low here as Utica faces Morrisville State. And I just want to say flat out here before we go deep into this game, we're not trying to take away from Utica in this approach. We are trying to be as down the line as we can, but there's a reality here at the end of the game that is clear, and it's our job to report on it as what we do here. So again, do not take this personally, Utica, and the rest of the show. Here we go. Halftime score was 7-0 Morrisville.
Furyk's play action. Goes down the field deep. Adams has separation. Adams has a catch. Justin Adams. Can he beat his man? He's beat Toussaint. It's a foot race. Justin Adams. It's a 95-yard touchdown for the Mustangs.
11:47 left in the third quarter at that point in time. 14-0. Make sure you note that score right now. 4 minutes later, Nate Palmer. Hey, you see him all the time, it seems like, in box scores. A 27-yard touchdown pass from Braden Zenilovic makes it 14-7 in favor of Morrisville still, though. After a Morrisville field goal, 17-7 with 9:41 left. Now it's all Utica. 3:46 left, fourth quarter. Travis Decker gets a 5-yard touchdown pass from Zenilovic. It's 17-14. Now, they did try an onside kick. They failed, even though there was about 4 minutes left in the game, but they did get the ball back late. Let's go to the play before the touchdown that everybody's talking about.
Zenilovic drops back, has time, flushed out, throws, has a man. Does he pick up the first? He might be short.
It's definitely short. And he's,
are they going to give it to him?
2-1. They get the snap off. Palmer's in the back of the end. Someone's in the back of the end zone. It's caught. Utica win on a walk-off touchdown.
There's no way they got that set in time.
Unbelievable.
Joey Nair catches the 8-yard touchdown pass pretty much without anybody in his face over there because of the chaos going on. 20-17. It is a touchdown. The referees did talk things over from what we understand, but the touchdown stood. The game stands as 20-17, Utica winning. More on this game later, as we said. Free Rich with 253 total yards, one passing, one rushing touchdown, and an interception from Mooresville. Zenilovic with a 25 for 40 day, 295 yards, three passing touchdowns with a slight asterisk and an interception. RPI at Ithaca. Wow. You know what? RPI just keeps, you know, trying to get these games, even though it looked on paper like it was an Ithaca, you know, juggernaut scenario here. Well, not necessarily. In the second quarter, 14:55 left, A.J. Wingfield gets a 2-yard touchdown run to give Ithaca the 7-0 lead. That was the halftime score, 7-0. So we were right. It was low scoring. The teams would trade field goals in the third quarter. In the fourth, it's Dean Ninch with a 35-yard touchdown pass from Jake Kazanowski. It's 10-10. RPI's tied the game at this point. 3.5 minutes later, Nicholas Bahamonde with the 27-yard field goal for Ithaca. 13-10 now in favor of Ithaca. RPI would get a couple more chances, though, in this fourth quarter. 3rd and 6 at the Ithaca 33. Kazanowski is intercepted by Michael Rooms, and ultimately the flag was RPI holding. It gets declined as Ithaca would take the ball here. But they would still get one more chance, RPI, with 1:23 left. Here's a 4th and 6 play from their own 26, and he is incomplete, is Kazanowski, and that would secure the victory. Ithaca wins the game 13-10. I think right in the middle of what our predicted scores were, basically. A.J. Wingfield, 166 total yards, one rushing touchdown for Ithaca. On the RPI side, Kazanowski had 15 for 30, 201 yards, one passing touchdown, and an interception. Union at Hobart. It pains me to have to do this, but here we go. 4:02 left in the first quarter. Nicholas Dunneman with a 53-yard touchdown pass from Donovan Picatti makes it 7-3 in favor of Union. Then at the start of the second quarter, it's Tim Denham Jr. with a 4-yard pass from David Cruson to give Hobart the lead 10-7. 7 minutes later, Rayshon Boswell, a 19-yard touchdown run, makes it a 2-possession lead for Hobart. It's 17-7 in favor of the Statesmen at this point, but Union would roll back here in the first half. Nicholas Dunneman again, a 40-yard touchdown pass from Picatti, made it 17-14 Hobart with 3:13 left. And then with 12 seconds left in the second quarter, it's Avery Turton with a 29-yard touchdown pass from Donovan Picatti to make it 21-17 in favor of Union. So they completed the comeback, at least in the first half. Third quarter, scoreless. Fourth quarter for 13 minutes, just about scoreless until...
Low snap. They bring pressure. He's going to throw deep. Daramola open. Has it. Daramola at the 5 to the end zone. The ball part 2. Ray Daramola 58 yards. Touchdown Hobart. They take the lead with 2:10 to go.
Ray Daramola gets a 58-yard touchdown pass from Cruson. It's 23-21 in favor of Hobart after this huge play by the Statesman. Union would not achieve a first down in their next drive, but they get the ball back on their own one very late in the game. Here's the final play of the game as Picatti tried to pass, and it did complete it to Dunneman for 19 yards, but ultimately they could not get near enough to the end zone to try to get into field goal range. The final score, 23-21, Hobart wins the game. Ray Daramola, 4 receptions, 129 yards, 1 receiving touchdown. Picatti for Union, 14 for 21, 252 yards, 3 passing touchdowns. Region 2, definitely with some wacky games of their own. Although we have an Empire 8 answer, we have an Empire 8 Pool C possibility still. And the Leary League, still not done yet, as Union controls their own destiny, even with the loss, because 2 wins, and they still would win the Leary League, but they've got to get some answers to some of the questions with respect to their defense and a little bit of their offense as well coming up here. But let's talk about Region 2.
Yeah, well, Cortland, I mean, how deep is this team, Frank? 31-8 over Alfred. Alfano St. John, I guess, was either injured or held out of this game, but they have a guy named Capone who sets a school record with almost 300 rushing yards. Incredible depth that this Dragon team has. And I've got to give a shout-out to Joe Kopp from Alfred, the linebacker there. 22 tackles or something like that. I might have missed that one in the box score reviews. Probably could have, should have maybe been my defensive MVP, but more on that in a little bit. Carnegie Mellon wins, Frank, and here's another situation brewing potentially. I think Case has to play Westminster this weekend. If Case loses that game to the Titans, Carnegie Mellon, I think, effectively will end up as the Pac champion, but they still have to play Case Western in week 11, so your guess is as good as mine there. Brockport wins big. Rochester comes up a little short against St. Lawrence. TCNJ, as you heard in the Around the Nation podcast, held William Patterson to zero first downs, and that one, that's pretty crazy. Dickinson wins big, so does your Sinus. I know their quarterback, Jack Bezenka, had a big game, a former guest from the show. Case wins big. Muhlenberg outlasts Franklin Marshall. We had Westminster still hanging around here. They win big and could play spoiler this weekend. We'll see. W&J, 55 points, that's a lot. Salisbury's in the position to lock down the NCHAC pretty soon. They're pulling ahead. Christopher Newport, man, this Montclair State team just has had some tough losses this year, Frank. Another one-point loss there late. The captains, they have to play Salisbury in week 11, so this NCHAC race is still kind of open there, so we'll have to wait and see. The other two, Fisher and Geneva, win big. And hey, look at that handsome young man there with that plate of food. He looks pretty happy. Looks like he had a fun little tailgate there in Pennsylvania.
Indeed. And one thing I said in Pennsylvania, I'll say it to the other Pennsylvania team you named there. Basically, you need to go 10-0 if you want to have a couple home games in this whole mix at the end of the day. So if you really want two home games, 10-0 is the only way to go. You may get into the playoffs, but you don't want to be chased out of the playoffs by an early tough matchup in these situations. So just keep that in mind, everybody. Let's go to Trinity at center. And this game just started out weird as Christian Billiter here gets a 7-yard touchdown pass from Nick Osterman, who did start. And it's 14-0 center leading Trinity 13 minutes into the game. We would go until the late portion of the second quarter before we'd see Trinity in the end zone. It's Ryan Merrifield with a 16-yard touchdown pass from Tucker Horn. Tucker woke up here eventually to make it 14-10 in favor of center still. But after halftime, or just before halftime, I should say, Trinity does complete things here with their defense as Malik Ross gets a 67-yard pick six to make it 17-14 in favor of Trinity at halftime. In the third quarter, Legend Grigsby, one of my favorite names currently in Division III, gets this 50-yard touchdown run. With 10-11 left in the third quarter, it was 24-14, and there was no looking back for Trinity at this point. 41-21 was the final. Again, center led 14-0 at the end of the first quarter. Tucker Horn, these numbers are not tremendous, at least in efficiency. 19 for 46, but 310 yards, three passing touchdowns. You know what? I guess every quarterback's going to have a bad day, but if you can deliver in the end, if you can make it happen, that defines who you are as a quarterback. So we'll give him the pass for now on this one. Center defense with 5 sacks and an interception. He's like, Rossi, I don't need your pass, but still, we'll give you the pass. Randolph Macon at Washington and Lee in the ODAC. And 3 minutes into the game, it was Washington and Lee's Stephen Murren with a 6-yard touchdown run to make it 7-0 in favor of WNL. But Randolph Macon would answer. 7 minutes left, first quarter. David Wallace gets that 23-yard touchdown pass from Drew Campanelli. 7-7 is your score at that point. We go to the second quarter, 13:46 left, and Alex Wirtz with a 2-yard touchdown run for Washington Elise, 14-7 at this point. But again, Campanelli is able to respond just 10 seconds later. David Wallace, a 75-yard touchdown pass after the touchback, basically. So it's the first play from scrimmage. After that other touchdown, it's 14 apiece now. And then Randolph Macon takes control. Drew Campanelli with a 1-yard touchdown run just before halftime here makes it 21-14. Then early in the third quarter, it's Drew Campanelli with a 2-yard touchdown run to make it 28-14 in favor of Randolph Macon. Final score, 35-21. Randolph-Macon gets the win. Drew Campanelli, 11 for 12, 213 yards, 2 passing, 2 rushing touchdowns. This kid is incredible. He's not a kid. He's a man with these numbers.
Yeah.
Stephen Murren, 234 total yards, 2 rushing touchdowns. Finally, in Region 3, Howard Payne at Hardin-Simmons. I almost feel like Howard Payne was listening to us on Friday's show and took it a little personally. First quarter, 3 minutes into the game, Hunter Cheek, 49-yard touchdown pass from Landon McKinney, makes it 7-0 in favor of Howard Payne. Well, guess what? Eventually, it was 10-0, but Hardin-Simmons finally responds with 9:42 left in the second quarter. Jalen Crawford with this big 100-yard they listed as, I think technically has to be 99-yard, kickoff return for touchdown, 10-7 in favor of Howard Payne still, but Hardin-Simmons coming back until Howard Payne scores again with 22 seconds left first half. It's McKinney to Jordan Carroll. The 39-yard touchdown pass made the halftime score 19-7, Howard Payne. Could they pull off the upset? Well, Hardin-Simmons says no in the third quarter, as with 10:03 left, it's Colton Marshall with a 6-yard touchdown run. 19-14 was the deficit now they had to make up. Then, 4:20 left, third quarter, Gatlin Martin gets a 48-yard touchdown pass from Galen Glynn to give Hardin-Simmons their first lead at 21-19. Fourth quarter, 2:50 left. It was a 14-play, 8-minute drive for Hardin-Simmons here, concluding with the Colton Marshall 1-yard touchdown run. 28-19 was your final in favor of Hardin-Simmons, but it was a definite scare, as Howard Payne had led 19-7 at the half. Colton Marshall, 2 rushing touchdowns for Hardin-Simmons. Leanne McKinney for Howard Payne, 20 for 32, 274 yards, 2 passing touchdowns, and an interception. But JB, I'll tell you, that team, like I said, probably took it a little personally when we said that we've been there before. They were kind of the fake scenario by that point in the season we've seen before, and there's nothing fake about Howard Payne in that performance on Saturday, and they face Mary Hardin-Baylor at home on Saturday. Could be one to watch this coming week, but let's talk more about Region 3.
Yeah, in Region 3, we got started off on Friday night. Belhaven with 70 points. Whew. I think there's a chance that the Blazers could pop on the regional rankings list for Region 3. Their strength of schedule is real low. It's like 218 out of 230 since the NESCAC isn't really included in that. But they only have one loss, and that's to Huntington, who won big over Greensboro. Pretty much a lot of the games in Region 3, Frank, were not very competitive. Hamden City, I guess we learned after the fact, had that weird situation where they could only go to one end zone because a maintenance guy accidentally knocked over one of the goalposts in the pregame. Whoops. But they win 28-21. Elsewhere, Brevard squeaks out a close call on the road, 24-21. Barry wins big. ETBU outlasts Texas Lutheran 38-35. And McMurray comes up a little short against Sol Ross State in their rivalry trophy game, 33-27. BSC, I think this is a Panthers team, even with two losses, that'll pop up on the regional rankings, Frank. They have some quality wins. They also have played some of the top teams in this region and elsewhere pretty close. So I think we'll see the Panthers out there. And then wrapping us up, Rhodes wins big, 33-6.
Well, JB, it's that time of the show where we go into complete wackiness mode, or in this case, weackiness mode, because we have 3 games in a row that just were crazy, and here we go.
Absolutely.
In the WEAC. Yep. First off, it is Wisconsin lacrosse at Wisconsin Oshkosh, and 2:17 left in the second quarter. We're going to just fast forward you here because there's too much action to cover. Joey Stutzman, a 69-yard touchdown pass from Kaiser, or I think it's Kaiser Helterbrand. I actually got that note from somebody the other day. 28-10 in favor of lacrosse, but Oshkosh would come back in this game. Third quarter, 8:43 left, Tony Steger with a 16-yard touchdown pass from Kobe Berghammer made it 28-16. Then Oshkosh continues with 1:52 left in the third quarter. Jimmy Duvall with a 10-yard touchdown pass from Berghammer makes it 28-23. Still lacrosse's lead. The teams would trade touchdowns early in the fourth quarter, so now it's 35-29, still lacrosse. But in the fourth quarter, 5:30 left, it is Berghammer with his own 1-yard touchdown run. We are tied at 35 apiece, despite that 18-point deficit early. Now, 51 seconds in the fourth quarter left. Ryan Byrne with a 51-yard field goal, 38-35, LaCrosse with the lead. And here we'll show Berghammer get intercepted in the final play for them, at least in this game, to try to come back one more time. And so LaCrosse, lucky here to win this one. Well, I mean, they're all close games in the WEAC scenario, but this was a huge win for them to just stay on pace for at least a Pool C bid if Whitewater doesn't trip up at the end of the season here. So the final again, 38-35, LaCrosse. Kobe Berghammer from Oshkosh, 21 for 35, 342 yards, 3 passing, 2 rushing touchdowns, and an interception. But really grown to appreciate him and his quarterbacking this season with the numbers as they've rolled in for Oshkosh. Wide receiver Matthias Enters, I believe it is, 4 receptions, 82 yards, 2 receiving touchdowns for LaCrosse. Platteville at Stout. Now, I called it for an upset here, but I didn't necessarily see it developing the way it did here in this game. We're going to just fast forward to the fourth quarter and talk about somebody who was just hot in this game named Cool. That's Luke Cool to you folks out there. With 1:19 left in the fourth quarter, UW Stout's kicker gets an 18-yard field goal to tie the game at 16 apiece. We would go to overtime. Now, we don't usually do this. We don't usually go field goal, field goal, field goal on our highlights, but we were left with no choice the way this overtime slate of sessions went. First, it's Andrew Swigert with a 26-yard field goal for Platteville in their half of overtime, 19-16. But Luke Cool with a 28-yard response makes it 19 apiece. Now in the second overtime, Stout starts and they lose yardage during their overtime, making Cool have to kick a 47-yard field goal. Well, he was Cool Hand Luke or Luke Hand Cool or something like that at that point because it was 22-19. I guess it would be a foot, not hand in this case. But again, back to Stout with that lead. Now Platteville, Andrew Swigert gets a 33-yard version of a field goal here, 22-22. So we go to two-point conversions. Platteville starts.
Stops, goes back. They're going to swing it out to him on the pass. The catch is made. Oh, he's going to throw it. It is intercepted. Intercepted in the end zone by Preedy.
Austin Guy's pass attempt fails. So now can Stout win it here?
Conversion would win it. Sean Borgerding in the shotgun, rolling to his right, looking to the end zone. Now going back left, he launches it back of the end zone. It's up. It's gone. Gone. Touchdown. 2-point conversion. Whatever it is, it doesn't matter. It's a score and the Blue Devils win. They walk it off. John Smosinski for 2.
Yeah, we don't care what it's called either, Mr. Announcer Man. Touchdown, 2-point conversion, whatever it is, it's a win for Stout in triple overtime, 24-22. Sean Borgerding from Stout, 28 for 48, 318 yards, 1 passing touchdown and an interception. Ben Wilson for Platteville, 5 receptions, 106 yards, and 1 receiving touchdown. And Coolfoot Luke there, just a great job by him. We'll talk a little bit more about him later. I have a funny feeling. Then we have UW River Falls at UW Whitewater. We'll go to the second quarter just before halftime. It's Tamir Thomas with a 17-yard touchdown run to make it 27-6 in favor of Whitewater. But River Falls would come back. I feel like a broken record with these games today. Third quarter, 10:43 left. Michael Kruger, a 1-yard touchdown run, makes it 27-13. That's still the deficit for River Falls. 6:19 left third quarter, Caleb Blaha, another 1-yard touchdown run. So now it's down to a 7-point lead for Whitewater, 27-20. We go to the fourth quarter, 3:15 left. Luke Cush, 22-yard touchdown pass from Caleb Blaha, ties the game, 27 apiece. Are we going to overtime? Well, Jeffrey Isatola McGuire says no.
Jeffrey Isatola McGuire, a 49-yard try. He kicks the ball, it bounces off the rim! Century for Whitewater. Take a look at this replay. It bounces off the crossbar and finds its way over. A miracle for Whitewater, Nolan.
Off the crossbar in the back. It's 30-27 after it bounces in and ends the game. Zeros on the clock. Whitewater wins and just they survive. They are surviving this season somehow.
Caleb Blaha for the win.
Yeah, you got it. 328 total yards for Blaha, 2 passing, 1 rushing touchdowns, and an interception. Tamir Thomas with 20 rushes, 131 yards, and 1 rushing touchdown for Whitewater. Whoa. Okay, we'll go to some other games here that we need to note in Regions 4 through 6. First off, Wittenberg at Worcester. You think that those games were crazy? Watch this one. 14:21 left in the second quarter. Wittenberg with a 30-yard touchdown pass from Colin Brown to C.J. Burnett makes it 27-0. This game is over. Or is it? Of course not. It's crunch time. Eventually, it was 33-7 in the third. 6:57 left third quarter. Mateo Renteria gets a 2-yard touchdown run. It's now 33-14. Wooster trying this comeback. Then 50 seconds later, it must be his brother, another Renteria on the field, gets an 18-yard fumble recovery for a touchdown. 33-21. So Wooster coming back. But Wittenberg says, hold on here. We're in the lead by too much. But we'll get another touchdown. 50 seconds later, Garrett Gross, 49-yard touchdown run, gives a 40-21 lead to Wittenberg. 6 seconds into the fourth quarter, it's J.J. Mims Jr. The 11-yard touchdown run makes it 40-28 in favor of Wittenberg. The teams would trade field goals. Then fourth quarter, 5:23 left. J.J. Mims Jr. gets another touchdown here, a 7-yard touchdown run to make it 43-38. Wooster down by 5 here. Now in the final drive, we'll fast forward to about 2 minutes left. Fourth and 3 at their own 37. And Mateo Renteria's pass is complete to Troy Bauman for 18 yards. So they are surviving here, JB. 11 seconds left in the fourth quarter.
But gather in motion, play action, looking right, nobody there, he's in trouble, back at the 20, scrambling to the right, he got hit, got away, fires end zone, it's going to be caught at the goal line, is it a touchdown or not? No indication, the clock is at 11 seconds, touchdown Worcester, his song is in, and the Scots take the lead, unbelievable!
They complete the drive, Cole Hissong with a 7-yard touchdown pass from Renteria, 44-43 in favor of Wooster. That was a 14-play drive that took us down to 11 seconds. And here's the final chance.
They're 24. Snap at the Brown. Three-man rush. Scrambles left. Looking. Fires over the middle. And it's going to be intercepted. It's picked off by Savaglio. And that's going to be the ball game. Unbelievable win for Wooster and Frank Colapreti today.
That would do it. A 27-point comeback, ultimately. 26 points from halftime, or actually 23 points from halftime. But still, incredible comeback. It's 44-43 Wooster. Mateo Renteria, 27 for 53, 272 yards, one passing, two rushing touchdowns in the game. My goodness. And we're going to go a little quicker through these West Coast games here. First off, Linfield at George Fox. This game was light scoring early on, but finally Linfield starts to take control. Connor McNabb, a 3-yard touchdown run with 6:05 left in the second quarter, makes it 17-3 in favor of Linfield. George Fox would answer with a minute left in the first half as Chad Blutko gets a 9-yard touchdown pass from Hayden Sean for a 17-10 half, or excuse me, it was actually 20-10 halftime score in favor of Linfield because they would add a field goal as time would expire. Two more field goals from Linfield would lead to eventually a Connor McNabb 11-yard touchdown run early in the fourth quarter, makes it 30-10 Linfield. And then Joel Valadez with a 14-yard touchdown pass from Blake Eaton makes it 37-10, 4:22 left fourth quarter, and that was your final score in favor of Linfield. Blake Eaton, 24 for 34, 180 yards, two passing touchdowns. Linfield's defense held George Fox to 9 rushing yards and 3 sacks, or it had 3 sacks, 1 fumble recovery, and 2 interceptions. Great job by the defense on that big NWC game day. Finally, Pomona Pitzer at Redlands. We will fast forward here to 6:03 left in the second quarter. Pomona Pitzer's Will Raddatz gets a 19-yard touchdown pass from Skylar Noble to make it 21-0 Pomona Pitzer. Again, this game ain't over. 9:37 left, third quarter. Redlands' Seth Weller gets a 3-yard touchdown pass from Tyler Tremaine to make it 21-7 in favor of Pomona Pitzer. Fourth quarter, 6:37 left, Evan Aguilan. And a 1-yard touchdown pass from Tremaine makes it 21-14, but they still need another touchdown to equalize here. Well, with 1:20 left in the fourth quarter, Tyler Tremaine gets a 14-yard touchdown run. Now it's 21 apiece, and we go to overtime. On Pomona Pitzer's side, Cameron Shirang gets a 22-yard field goal to make it 24-21, but look at this.
Second and 12. Tremaine, room to run. 25, 20, 15, 10, 5. Dives for the end zone! He's in! Touchdown! Bulldogs win!
A
And look at the celebration! The freshman gets out of a mess at the line of scrimmage, outruns everybody, reaches the ball to the pylon, and the Bulldogs are still alive!
Tyler Tremaine, on his end of overtime, gets a 27-yard touchdown run to win the game in walk-off style, 27-24. That's your final in favor of Redlands, who still controls their own destiny. And if they get into the playoffs, they would be 5-5. Picture that. Jeez. We haven't seen that in quite some time happen. Pomona Pitzer's 21-0 lead disappears from the halftime area. Tyler Tremaine, 228 total yards. Two passing, two rushing touchdowns. Skylar Noble, 359 total yards for Pomona Pitzer. Three passing touchdowns and an interception. So, wackiness wasn't the only wackiness in Regions 4 through 6, JB, especially in Region 6. You see the Redlands game, and in, what is it, Region 4, the Wooster game. But my goodness, stuff going on all over the place. You've got a lot more where that came from in our line scores.
Yeah, and we actually, apologies to the Blue Boys. We didn't realize that they were playing on Friday night when we did our last Friday show. So they win 28-14 over Cornell of Iowa. There were lots of 50s on this scoreboard in the region. You can see North Central, Mount Union, St. John's, all winning big. Wheaton has a nice score there against Milken. I'm sure they set some more records there. 65-0 with Wartburg and Buena Vista, Frank. I'll get there eventually. Albion wins in a key MIAA game over their rival Adrian. John Carroll takes care of business. Hope wins big. Wabash wins big. DePaul wins big. AMA. They're on a crash course with Albion for that conference championship. That'll be interesting. In the OAC, Baldwin Walls took care of Capital. Marietta beats Ohio Northern. Heidelberg wins with another 50-something score here. See where I'm going with. Rose Holman, though, I think, had the most points of the weekend with 76. In the HCAC, we have Franklin over Manchester, Hanover over Anderson. Well, hey, there's another 70, Mount St. Joseph. They're in control there. We'll just have to wait and see when they exactly clinch. Could be this weekend. Augustana, though, with a close call here over one of the only close games in this section here with a 24-21 win. Elsewhere, Simpson, 74 points. Wow, that's a lot. Coe edges Central. Seems like the Dutch have sort of fallen off, It's a little different story when you don't have a first-team All-American quarterback on leading your team, I guess. Chicago with a 55-0 win. Augsburg outlast Concordia Moorhead for their third straight win. I think their quarterback earned the QB of the week on d3football.com. Carlton takes another loss to Gustavus. And Aurora hangs on to win a pretty competitive, low-scoring game against Benedictine, 20-13. I think they're in control of their destiny in the NACC. Elsewhere, Westminster outlasts Finlandia by 4. Lakeland beats Eureka. Lake Forest still hanging around out there, 31-14 over Monmouth. That's a pretty big statement win for them. So we'll have to see what happens. Maybe Lake Forest is in the Pool C conversation, Frank. I don't know. We'll have to wait. Washington U wins. Ripon wins. Knox wins. Carroll. Eau Claire beats Stevens Point. Greenville takes care of Crown. Mud Scripps, who now, ironically, I think is in first place in the SCIAC after this past weekend. They're in the driver's seat there. They won 43-0. Whitworth wins big. Pacific wins in a shootout. Northwestern Minnesota, hey, they look like they might win the UMAC. And then Ohio Wesleyan, I spoke too soon, Frank. 77, apparently, is the big number here. And the shops get that, and Laverne takes care of Kalu. Bit of an upset there out in Southern California. It's been kind of a crazy weekend with all these different games going on. But man, that's your week 9, 4-6 results.
And that's your week 9 crunch time for the 2022 Division III college football season. JB, let's go through MVPs a little quickly here because that was a long crunch time for sure with all the action we wanted to cover here. Yeah, exactly. First off, AJ Wingfield, somebody I'm going to see this Saturday as I will be attending Ithaca Union. And he deserves it in terms of just the maturity and ball control that he exhibits out there for Ithaca. They need a good, stable quarterback in that system in moments like this. And All the close games we've seen him face, really up close and personal in the Liberty League over this last couple of years, he seems to figure out a way to come out ahead in. Here's an example of it. So congratulations to him. Go ahead and put some more kudos on toward him.
Yeah, I mean, when I watch this game, he was really the reason I think the Ithaca offense was able to move the chains and get first downs against this elite, top 10 nationally ranked RPI defense. And it just seemed like he took what the defense would give him. If he needed to run the ball, he would. And there was even a time where he ran it in for a touchdown and got blasted. I mean, he might have... He was a little wobbly getting up. I'm just hoping that he's not injured. He kept playing. Tough guy. It was called back on a penalty. But just the gutsy performance to me just stood out. I mean, there were obviously players that had much better stats over the weekend. But in a must-win game, almost a conference championship caliber type of situation, this guy came up big every time his team needed him to keep the chains moving. So we already talked about this guy, Luke Cool. I mean, 16 points accounted for, I think, like a two-thirds of Stout's offense. I mean, five field goals, he got the extra point. He was really money. I mean, the WIAC has some great kickers across the board, but this guy really carried his team in that upset win. And then it was interesting, Frank, one of the benefits of me being able to mute myself while you're running through all these scores is that I realized I recognize the Borgerding name from the Stout quarterback. Well, this is his younger brother, Aaron. So it's kind of ironic here. We've got brothers in the WIAC wackiness. But Aaron had 18 tackles, 9 solos in that big game against the Warhawks. Just kind of stood out to me as a really yeoman performance just based on the caliber of the game, the kind of opponent that he was facing. And he really stepped up and had a big day. So apparently there's a couple of brothers out there in Wisconsin, Frank, doing big things in the wacky WIAC.
Well, remember A.J. Wingfield, going back to him for a second, remember that hit in the Union game I covered last year at Butterfield where he had that collision helmet-to-helmet basically with the Union defender, got up and, you know, patted the defender on the helmet. He is gutty and gutsy out there, no doubt about it, and can take a licking, but can't take too many of those blows. I don't care how young you are. But we got to figure out how to cool foot Luke or Luke foot cool. We got to give this kid give this guy a nickname that befits him the right way. And okay, so let's go to our scoreboard, and you'll see we are listed as 12-1. Now technically we picked 14 games. The 14th game is Morrisville hosting Utica, and so we'll get to that in a second. Still a 5-game lead for UJB. We did not include the Utica game in this number. Actually, you didn't, and I have not actually objected to that, and I'm going to tell you I'm not going to object to it. I will win this like a man here, and ultimately, you know, still need the additional game no matter what, and we can always have the asterisk on our final scores if it comes down to a one-game scenario.
Yeah, I think what I was going to say is, you know, if it comes down to if it's a one-point differential at the end, we'll just call the season a draw, you know, type of thing, because in a way, I could say, yeah, I should give you the win. Technically, it's in the books. But at the same time, I really feel like Morrisville got screwed so badly in that outcome. It's just, it doesn't seem like it should count, but it does in the record books, I guess. I don't know.
Okay, so now for those wondering out there what we're talking about, let's take a blow-by-blow look at what's going on. And I'm not going to go back to the earlier calls that a lot of people have been trying to flag about, you know, I guess late hit stuff and whatnot. That's all subjective referee calls. I don't know how they called it for the other, you know, 59 minutes of the game or whatever it was. And I'm going to point something out to everybody here because we saw some back and forth. Tony Maldonado weighed in and whatnot. In the NBA, they have something called the two-minute report. That is to talk about how the officiating went in the last 2 minutes of games throughout the league. And there's a reason for why they focus on that. To hell with the first 46 minutes, okay? Things happen in both directions, bad, good, or indifferent. But what really, truly matters is how you as an official execute the last 2 minutes of a basketball game, the last couple minutes of a football game, especially the last play or the last drive or whatever you have you. But we place an emphasis on the end of a game because that's where everybody knows what the score is, and we can't just keep playing and even out that scenario. This is the definitive end of the game scenario. So with about 12 seconds left, it looks like the pass gets off here. from Utica. 7 seconds left when the tackle is made, and everybody's scurrying back to the line of scrimmage. Now they get the ball in, the referee gets out of the way. I did not hear a ready for play whistle, to be honest with you, so I wonder if one was actually used, and if there was a snap before that, that is actually a penalty as well for delay of game. That would have ended the game. Okay, either way, you can see the line not set. And we're kind of paying attention to the left receiver and a receiver next to this next to the line on the right side as well. And so that line was not set for 1 second. And I know some referees say maybe not a second, but a beat. But he's just, the left receiver is still moving when the ball comes up. There's no doubt here about that. And it's not even close. But also, let's key in on the center here and look at the snap. It's not a smooth snap. It is a double clutch snap, as you call it, as he goes up with the ball. It's still in his hand between his legs up in the air, and then finally gets rid of the ball to the quarterback at that point, because I think he too realized that not everybody was setting the line. So what's he going to do? Just try to, you know, duff in a snap late here in that way. Well, that's an illegal snap. Either one of those penalties. The illegal shift would convert to a false start. The illegal snap is a false start equivalent. Both of them come with 10-second runoffs. There's no timeout for Utica to use to avoid it. The game should have been over. The play should not have happened. Flat out, that should have been the end of the game, and Morrisville should have won it. Okay, this is not us taking sides. This is just a reality check of how that end-of-game scenario should have played out. Where I'm really, really disappointed is that the Empire 8 did not issue a statement, and according to Pat Coleman at d3football.com, they have indicated to him that they're not going to release a statement. I think this is that point in time, where you kind of say, referees are human, they made an error, it was a clear error, and we cannot overturn the outcome of a game based on rules in the NCAA, period. And that's that, okay? We're sorry to Morrisville that that happened, but it's a final score. It's done, okay? I just don't get what they're trying to prove here. Are they trying to protect Utica in Pool C contention right now? I don't know. Okay, you got two teams in this equation. You don't just have Utica's Pool C bit at stake here. You've got Morrisville and their confidence in the system right now. And the system works better when you admit an error publicly so that at least they feel, hey, okay, we don't have the W for that game. We aren't 7-1 right now because of that game, but at least we know in our heart of hearts we probably won that game. Let's move on now. Yeah, they know in their heart of hearts already that they probably won that game in that respect. But it still would take on a little extra meaning if the conference basically said, Utica wins on paper. Morrisville, we're sorry. That's all you got to do. And you're not protecting your officials here. Your officials botched the ending. I'm sorry. And as an official, if that happened in my under my watch on a game, I would be the first one out there to say, after watching the tape, we screwed up. We botched it, but the rules say the game stands. I'm sorry. Okay? To whoever I would be saying that to. Here, it's not happening happening publicly. There might be some chatter behind the scenes with respect to it from what I'm gathering, but not publicly. Your thoughts on how this played out?
Yeah, I mean, I watched it live, and so I you know, I kind of had a rooting interest in the game, right? Because that's what we had picked, and I was waiting to see what was going to happen. And then I saw the guy get tackled. I saw the referee do he's still in bounds, so wind the clock. And, of course, the broadcast doesn't have the time. You don't really know what's going on. It's like, are they going to get the playoff? Time's going to run out? Guy didn't look set. There was confusion at the end. Touchdown catch, but was it really the whole thing? And then, fortunately, in the handshake line, some stuff started to go up and the coaches took care of it. And, I understand why the Morrisville players would have been upset. And I don't know who started what or what have you, but at least it got under control. I think ultimately the big takeaway is that there was a big mistake that was made. The conference should have probably said something, even if it was like a sentence of like, hey, yep, we realized there was an error, sorry. And then finally, I just have to keep giving credit to Coach Raby with how he's handled it. He's been nothing but professional. I mean, I'm sure deep down he's upset and he might be saying things to behind closed doors of how upset he really is. I'm sure there's some four-letter words maybe that even are involved there. But hey, it is what it is. It's in the books. Tough break for Morrisville, but sometimes that's how it goes with football, and you just got to move on to the next game.
Yeah. Now, the question really does become, and I'm going to tell you flat out what's going to happen here. If everybody wins the games they're supposed to win, and if Cortland wins in Cortico, which is not necessarily supposed to, we don't know who should win that game right now. That's going to be a close call. But let's say Cortland runs the table, and Susquehanna runs the table in Region 2, and Johns Hopkins and Utica both run the table to go 9-1 each. I'm going to tell you flat out right now that Utica will have the advantage in strength of schedule by about 0.02, maybe 0.03 points. But when you look at regionally ranked opponents, Utica will have lost to what I would assume will be the number one Region 2 team, Cortland, by 27 points was the final, I think, on that one, give or take.
Yeah, 48-21, I think it was, yeah.
And then Johns Hopkins lost to the regionally ranked number two team, Susquehanna, most likely. Susquehanna is number two in this equation when everything settles down, by the final score of 26-24, or minus 2 points. So to me, using criteria, Johns Hopkins and Utica are razor thin when the season ends, if this plays out this way. So if you're a human being with a certain level of knowledge of what went on here in Region 2, and Blaise Faggiano, who's, I believe, still on the Region 2 rack, won't be able to have any say on this. He's off the call when his team's under consideration.
Yep.
Long story short here, I got to think that if they're that close, people think about this situation, this ending, and say, you know what, Hopkins probably deserves a slightly higher scenario in that and will be the first team considered from Region 2 for Pool C purposes. Yep. It's tough for me to see it play out any other way. And then don't forget that because the Centennial has 9 conference games out of their 10, Johns Hopkins is always going to be around 500. That's not in their control. And Utica's strength of schedule, they play teams that had decent seasons that aren't exactly what I would call, you know, headline-making teams in their out-of-conference schedule. So if people take kind of a step back and look at schedules, I've got to give a slight edge here no matter what to Johns Hopkins on the schedule played. The eye test, to me, goes to Hopkins. But again, a moment like this really does kind of make you take a step back and say, do I consider this as part of, you know, it's not criteria, but do I consider this in terms of just the reality of the situation of who's the better team when I'm ranking them?
Yeah.
Some people out there say yes, some say no. We'll see how it plays out, but this is one to watch over the next couple of weeks. I can't guarantee you how it plays out, but again, it assumes everybody goes undefeated in Region 2 that we listed. Again, Cortland, Susquehanna, Johns Hopkins, and Utica. If Ithaca beats Cortland, then you definitely got to give the edge, I think, to Hopkins, because they will probably have the 2-point loss to the number one team in Region 2 if Susquehanna wins out. So there's that. On Friday, we will go conference by conference to look at who's got some Pool C potential, who's got some Pool A potential still, and what conferences will be decided or won't be decided. So we'll go through all 27. Sorry, NESCAC, you're not playing along with us, so we're not going to go through yours like that. But yeah, but I will give you a chance here, as always, to give us kind of the Week 9 moving into Week 10 assessment here, kind of what to look for. Maybe on Wednesday this time around. You know, what are you watching for this week?
Yeah, well, obviously Wednesday we'll see the alphabetical order regional rankings list. I went ahead and tweeted out what I think might happen. I made some assumptions just based on some prior years. We'll see how close those are. You can check it out at D3FB Huddle if you want to, you know, see where my thoughts and picks, I guess, were. But ultimately, at the end of the day, what really matters are the games on Saturday for Week 10. And as I said at the top of the show, about half the conferences in the country have a chance to have a Pool A conference championship winner and into the playoffs. And then about the other half, we're going to have to wait one more week until Week 11 to see exactly who goes what and does this and whatever. We'll see, you know, kind of where the selections come out on, I think it will be Sunday the 13th of November, which is, man, just less than 2 weeks away. On the 14th, Frank and I, for like the fourth or something year in a row, we'll do our ECAC Bowl selection show around noon Eastern. So thanks to them for entrusting us with that. There should be some three or four really interesting matchups. There's going to be a lot of one-loss and two-loss teams that aren't going to get into the tournament and deserve that extra, you know, kind of championship game. So there's going to be some really great potential matchups. And anybody who can kind of make schedules, try to space them out a little bit. You know, let them have their sort of time to shine if you can. We know all the playoff games for the NCAA are usually around a noon or 1 p.m. local kickoff. Maybe do the bowl games a little different time. Just an idea. Anyway, back to you, Frank.
Yeah, I know. Thanks, JB. Yeah, when you dump it in my lap like that, I'm usually not ready for you to get my microphone back on. But we are late on this show, but I will talk more about Union versus Ithaca in a moment. That's coming up there on Friday, the game on Saturday, but we'll talk about it on Friday. We'll also have a guest as usual on Friday in our live show. And we got a lot of excitement coming up here. I don't know if we're going to have as much wackiness going forward here, but who knows? Every time we say, oh, it should be a calm week for them, they decide to just say, yeah, that's what you think, guys. So we'll see there. But Week 10 has historically had a couple upsets. If they do happen, it will change the entire course of Pool C and maybe even Pool A in certain conferences. So stay tuned. We'll walk you through what to expect, and then what happens in reality, and then what it all means heading into week 11 over the next week. So stay tuned. We'll see you soon.